friends. Welcome to Red Ice Radio. My name is Henrik. Thank you for tuning in. Our website, as you know, is redicecreations.com, and it's great to have you with us along for this broadcast. Today we have Adrian Gilbert with us on the program. He is the author and co-author of a number of best-selling books, including The Orion Mystery that he did together with Robert Puval, The Mayan Prophecies, Magi, Signs in the Sky, and The End of Time. He's also behind something called The Invisible College that we are going to talk a little bit more about later in the program. I have a couple of websites here that I want to give out right at the beginning. AdrianGilbert.co.uk, that's his main website. And then you can also take a look at the new website, TheInvisibleCollege.net. Adrian is also going to be one of the speakers at the upcoming Alternative View 2 conference at the end of May in London. We here at Red Ice are going to attend the event, and a number of interesting speakers will be there, of course, as well. Dr. Len Horowitz, that we talked about just the other day, and many more, of course. I'm going to ask Adrian a little bit later on in the program about what he's going to speak about at the conference. So if you're interested in attending the conference, want to read up a little bit more about some of the guests, about the other speakers, I want to relay over to the Alternative View website. Simply go to avii.co.uk or thealternativeview.co.uk. And from there, you can read more about the speakers, the location, dates and times, and of course, get a hold of tickets as well. So with that, let's get this show on the road, as it were. We have an awful lot to talk about here today. Welcome, Adrian. Thank you very much for coming on Red Ice Radio.
Yeah, how are you?
I'm very good, thank you. How are you, sir?
I'm very well, thank you, Henrik. It's a pleasure to be on your radio show.
Thank you. It's wonderful talking with you. You know, I do know about the Orion Mystery. I think that's primarily where I know about you from, so to speak. But I'm definitely looking forward to diving into a lot of the other projects that you are involved in and the things that you've been done in the past as well. And just to get things kind of going here at the beginning, I do want to talk about a line that you have on your website that reads like this. Based on the evidence of the long-term movement of the stars, Adrian believed that the world is currently going through its most major change for the last 13,000 years. And I think that a lot of people tuning into this program would agree with that and probably have their own kind of take on what this line actually means to them, or what this might be, this change that you're talking about. But I'd like to hear a little bit what you mean by that, Adrian. Maybe you can just elaborate for us a little bit on that.
Right. Well, it's a big subject, as you can appreciate, but it's very much connected with what's called the slow cycle of the Earth, called the precession of the equinox, which I'm sure you're familiar with. This
Yes.
idea of the poles do a little dance around the sky, which takes a circular movement. It takes 26,000 years, roughly. And sort of half of that period is 13,000 years. I shall be talking a bit more about this in perhaps a bit more detail as we go on. But we're now at a situation where the clock, this clock, if you like, this precessional clock, has got its hands pointing at the number 12, if you think of the face of a clock.
Mm-hmm.
And the alarm bell is ringing. And we're seeing this in different ways. We're seeing, for example, all this business about global warming, which I don't believe is being caused by CO2 gas, by the way.
Me neither.
I don't believe there's enough CO2 gas to really affect anything in the atmosphere. In fact, water vapor would be much more a factor in this. But I do believe there are changes happening with our sun. And it's the sun itself that's producing the global warming. That we have this familiar idea. We think of the sun as being like an electric fire. You switch on the switch and it's always the same heat coming out.
Yeah.
But of course, it's a star. And it's a star that goes through changes and cycles. And we really do not understand how stars work. The ancient the Victorians believed that there must be, I don't know how many millions of tons of coal burning on the sun every moment for it to give out the amount of heat it does.
Mm.
We know that's nonsense now. We know that there isn't any coal on the sun burning, but we have transferred our ideas of technology, the idea of a nuclear reactor, to the sun, and we say, well, it must be like a gigantic atomic explosion. I think that's just as false. I don't believe that the sun is a gigantic nuclear explosion. It's actually undergoing processes which we do not understand, but which involve electricity.
Yes.
But that's a whole other subject area which we'll appreciate. But basically, get to the idea that the sun is a variable star. All stars are variable, and it goes through cycles of its own. It goes through its own winter, spring, summer, and autumn. And so there are times when it gives out more energy and times when it gives out less. And it's a very, you know, a slow cycle. And this is connected in some respect with our precessional cycle of the equinox. And then there's another process happening as well, which is to do with the stargates, which I will be talking a bit more about in due course, and the position of the sun at the stargates at the time of the solstices, which is what is happening now. So all these factors, the last time that the sun was aligning with a stargate at the solstices was the end of the last ice age, 13,000 years ago. So we can see that that produced a major change. And we're going to go through a similar kind of change now. So that's what's happening, I believe.
Very, very interesting. So do you think that this, you know, if we talk about the driving force behind this, I mean, the reason for the changes in the sun, do you think that there's a bigger force behind this? People are
absolutely
talk about, John Major Jenkins, for instance, is talking about alignment with even the galactic center.
That's right.
Do you think that's right?
That's connected, yes. You see, our scientists have allowed a situation to grow where we view the solar system and the universe as being kind of very fragmented, just a random collection of rocks kind of held together by gravity, but really not doing very much of interest, and just kind of sometimes, for reasons we do not understand, life appeared on this planet. Maybe it appeared on other places, who knows, but it's probably only microbes anyway. This is the kind of attitude. But when you actually start going into the subject in more detail, you begin to understand that there are patterns involved in the solar system. For example, why is it the moon is exactly the right size to eclipse the sun?
Yeah, exactly.
You know, you think about that. I mean, where does the moon come from? We don't know, but it sort of comes from we don't know where, and it ends up in an orbit which is exactly the right distance from the Earth to create a disk that is exactly the right size to eclipse the sun. Now, that to me is something that's worth considering about. And then you think about the relationship between the cycles of the Earth and Venus, which, as you probably know, produces a kind of pentagram of conjunctions in the sky. I think it's 8 Venus cycles gives you 1 Earth cycle, 5 Earth cycles, So 5 years, you get sort of 8 cycles of Venus. This kind of 5 and 8, well, that belongs to the Fibonacci series, doesn't it? 1, 1, 3, 5, 8, 13, etc.
Right.
And you know, that's all also connected with the idea of the golden mean, and you know, you're beginning to see there's a pattern there. And then there's the so-called Bode's law you've probably heard of. Positioning of the planets that you can predict using a particular equation, the position of the orbits of planets in succession. And this works very well up to the planet Uranus. One of the ways that they were able to predict the planet Uranus, because they reckoned there should be one there, and sure enough, they found one. And there should be another one where the asteroids are Mars and Jupiter. So, you know, if you read science books, they'll tell you, well, it's just an asteroid belt, it's a bunch of rocks left over from the formation of the universe, of the solar system. That's about it. Well, I think there used to be a planet there and it blew up. Happened to it.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's probably why we got craters all over the moon and all over Mars. Probably why, you know, there's all this rubble floating around.
What do you think happened there? Natural, artificial? Are we talking about pre-civilization people being around and messing?
Well, it could be any of those things, couldn't it? Yeah. I mean, I don't know. But, I mean, you can imagine maybe it was a Star Wars situation where someone blew it up.
There you go.
Remember in Star Wars that there's that planet they blow up? I think it's in episode 2.
Absolutely. They blow up Aldebaran or something like that with the Death Star.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, the Death Star comes and blows up a planet. Maybe something like that happened. Or maybe it was some kind of cosmic catastrophe where a big comet collided with it. I don't know.
Yeah.
But it's it looks to me like you've got the remains of a planet in the area where, you know, you would expect there to be a planet according to Bode's law equation.
Yeah.
So, and then you start looking at the larger view of galaxies, you know, spiral galaxies which have a shape and they have these arms, and you wonder how they're formed. And then I don't know if you've visited any websites or had any research on this whole idea about the electric universe, have you?
Yeah, absolutely. We've even had Scott, I'm forgetting his either surname who he was on the program a couple of years back, and definitely we're very much following that. There's a very interesting thesis, actually.
Yeah, so absolutely fascinating thesis that the what illuminates stars is electricity flowing through them. And you can dismiss, once you start taking electrical forces into account, right? I did physics at A-level and a bit at university, and it always seems strange to me that electricity is terribly important when you're looking at sort of what happens in our world, because the electrical forces are far more powerful than gravity forces, as you probably appreciate. Gravitational attraction is tiny compared with magnetism and electricity. And yet, when they look at the universe and the cosmos, everything's about gravity. And then when the equations don't work, you know, they haven't got enough matter to explain the attractions caused by gravity, they say, well, there must be dark matter we can't see.
Yeah,
invisible matter.
right.
Yeah. Matter that you don't know. You know, we know it's there because the equations say it must be there. We can't detect it. So it's black matter.
Do you think that all that is bunk in regards to there isn't any dark matter?
It's like the old phlogiston theory, you know, before they discovered oxygen. And they were fencing about phlogiston. Our scientists are phlogiston sellers at the moment as regards space physics, because most of them have never studied electronics. And this is the problem. And you see, the other problem is, I think you probably realize from talking with people who are into this, is that when people like Sir Isaac Newton, who I have huge regard for, I regard him as the greatest scientist who ever lived.
And an alchemist, together, by the way.
He was an alchemist too, yeah. And he was also very deeply into the Book of Revelation.
Yes.
he's my kind of guy, you know?
Yeah, he's even predicted the end of the world, I think, in 2060 or something like that.
That's right, something like that.
Right.
He's my kind of guy. But unfortunately, when he was working, they hadn't discovered electricity. Well, they probably knew a little bit about sparks or something, but they hadn't really got into it. It was people like Faraday who came much later, who were doing all the work, discovering electricity and inventing motors and generators and all of that, which we take for granted now.
Yeah.
So when he was formulating theories about the solar system, they didn't have any knowledge about electricity and electrical forces. This wasn't part of the picture. And unfortunately, that whole area of science hasn't moved with the times. It's still rooted in saying, well, you can explain everything in terms of gravity, which is nonsense. You know, it's actually is connected with electricity and magnetism. And when you apply those ideas, you begin to understand why plasma clouds take certain shapes, you know, why galaxies take certain shapes. It becomes explicable. But of course, this is a taboo subject, and, you know, scientists don't want to go there because there's no grants involved in that. They might upset their peers.
Yeah.
They might lose their funding for their university. You know, it mustn't rock the boat. These are the problems that exist, and it's holding everything back, not just in that one field. That's just one example. But in other fields like archaeology, for example, when Robert Bovall and I came up, wrote the Orion mystery and brought that forward, Robert's ideas about the three pyramids of Giza representing Orion's belt.
Mm-hmm.
Now, he came to me with that thesis, and I saw immediately that this is actually really fascinating, that people would love this. But it wasn't just that it was a nice idea, you know, three pyramids look like three stars. He'd done the research into why this might fit with the Egyptian culture. For example, that there were shafts that was pointing from the Great Pyramid towards specific stars or star groups. That there were texts written on the walls of some of the pyramids which talk about how the pharaoh wanted to go to Orion after death. And we were able to build up a whole thesis that linked all these different areas of research together to produce this one concept that, yes, they were building heaven on earth. You know, they're laying out these big pyramids and the satellite pyramids, partly as a message, I believe, to our day, a message for the future. But also, they were quite literally building what they were, you might call a spiritual machine to help the pharaoh, maybe not just him, probably other people as well. You know, everyone wants to share in that, don't they? We all want to go to heaven.
Right.
That they could get back to the stars of Orion, which is where they believed their gods had come from, and perhaps themselves as well, you know. So once you begin to understand that, you begin to view Egyptology in a completely different way. You begin to understand it in a different way, but it doesn't fit with what they have been working on for the last 200 years, you know, and calling Egyptology since Napoleon went there. And because it doesn't fit, they don't want to hear about it. You know, they'd much rather think about self-important pharaohs building pyramids, because out of their ego, they want a great big monument to have their body stuck in after death. That fits with their conception. Our conception is that actually the pharaohs, most of them, were quite humble people, really. But they and what mattered to them was their religion. They were very, very religious, and they wanted to go to join Osiris after death. And part of the way of doing that was this method of building these pyramids. Might not have worked, I don't know. Maybe it did work, but this is certainly why they were doing it. Like, we would build a cathedral. You think, why would you build a cathedral? It's a pointless exercise, you know. Oh, well, it's because the king wants to be buried there, right? If you go to Westminster Abbey, you'll find lots of kings of England buried and queens in Westminster Abbey.
And, so you can say, and Newton, right, too, right?
Sorry?
And even Newton, right?
Yeah, yeah. And lots of eminent people as well. So you could say, well, this is just a great big mausoleum. Yeah, that's why they built it. Not at all. The Westminster Abbey is actually built as a shrine to Edward the Confessor. Well, he actually built it initially as an abbey. But because he was buried there, and because the kings of England, after William the Conqueror, wanted to claim legitimacy through him, they go and sit by his throne, by his tomb, to be enthroned. So he's bearing witness to them as being the king, the rightful king. And then when they die, they want to be buried within this this fitting place, this royal place.
Do you think that the location of this even is specific in regards to... is this another monument placed on Earth in order to mimic something or have a kind of a communication with the heavens or the stars in some way?
What, the Westminster Abbey?
Yeah.
Well, interestingly, it's built on the site of what was a temple of Apollo at the time of the Romans. It was probably a temple there at the time of the ancient Britons before the Romans arrived. And St. Paul's Cathedral, which is in the city of London. You have to understand London, there's two cities, as it were. There's what's called the City of London, the Square Mile, which is in sort of the eastern part. And then you've got the City of Westminster, and then you've got lots of suburbs all around, huge conglomeration. But the original City of London is separate from Westminster, where Parliament is and where Westminster Abbey is. And St. Paul's Cathedral is in the City of London, and that was a temple of Diana, the moon goddess. And there's a reason for that, and that is that she's the patron of the ancient Britons. You see, our history that's taught to us in schools is completely wrong. When you start investigating further, you discover that they've actually thrown away the old history books. You know, around 1700 or so, kind of the history of Britain, which had been taught for generations, thousands of years, was kind of thrown in the wastepaper bin, and a new history was produced. It really is Orwellian. I mean, it's extraordinary.
Yeah, absolutely.
The original history claimed that the ancient Britons were descended from the people of Troy. You probably never heard that before.
Well, I have, but to tell us a little bit more about it, yeah.
Yeah. The legend goes that after the fall of the city of Troy, a guy called Aeneas escaped, or was allowed to escape, and he took his father and his son, and they went to Italy, and he married the daughter of the king of Latium. His first wife had died, and was instrumental in founding Rome, and became, you know, like its first king. And you'll find that in the Roman histories, all about Aeneas founding Rome. That's one of the alternatives. There's also Romulus and Remus as the other founding fathers, but it's two kind of legends.
Yes.
Well, he had a son. I think he's called Silvanus or Silvanius. And he had a son who's called Brutus. And Brutus is called Brutus the Unlucky. And even before he was born, while his mother was pregnant with him, they took her to see the Sibylline prophetesses. And they sort of said, yes, this boy will be the death of both his father and his mother. You know, which is not a very nice thing to have said about you before you're even born.
Right.
Well, his mother died in childbirth, so that was half the legend. And then he killed his father in a hunting accident. And, you know, that was such a terrible thing to happen that they banished him. And he went from Italy. This is all in our traditional British history. Mm. He went from Italy to Epirus in Greece. And he found the Trojans living there as slaves, right? His fellow countrymen.
Mm.
And so he led a rebellion against the king of Epirus, and he overthrew him and seized his fleet of ships. And he married the daughter of the king, Pandrasus, and they left from Greece because they knew the other Greeks would be after them. Right, they defeated this one king, but you know there's the rest of the Greeks to worry about.
Right.
So they got into their boats and they sailed off to a little island now called Leuca, just north of Corfu. And there, Brutus is said to have gone into a temple, a ruined temple of Diana, and slept. And he had a dream where he met the goddess Diana, the moon goddess. And she told him to take his people in their ships and sail off beyond the Pillars of Hercules and beyond Gaul, where they'd find a great green island where they could settle and they would be in peace away from the Greeks.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what they did. They set off. They sailed off around the Mediterranean. They picked up other Trojans on the way at different places. And they arrived, and supposedly they first set footfall in Britain at a place called Totnes in Devon.
There's isn't there a Brutus stone in Totnes?
Yes, there is a Brutus stone, which is supposed to be where he put his foot down. Well, if he actually stepped where that stone is, he must have been the greatest long jumper in history, because it's you know, about half a mile from the river.
Right.
But you can imagine that he would have sailed up the River Dart and arrived perhaps at Totnes or some such place.
Mm.
And then the legend goes on that they had a battle with local giants who were living in Britain at the time from an earlier migration from Syria. Listen, you know, again, we're not taught anything about a migration to Britain from Syria. Anyway, they overthrew the giants, and the last one is a guy called Gog Magog. And Brutus has a companion, you know, one of his friends that he picked up on the way, a guy called Corin or Corinus. And he has a wrestling match with this giant, Gog Magog, and he defeats Gog Magog and throws him off a cliff, which is then called Gog Magog's Leap.
Ah, and is this related in a way to what the Bible talks about when it comes to Gog and Magog?
I think it's probably a corruption based on the Bible from later people. They picked up the name Gog Magog, but it was probably something like Gower Madoc. Gower means big in Welsh. Yeah, and Madoc is a fairly common name.
Hmm.
So Gower Madoc, the great Madoc, might be the origin of that name, and then it's become corrupted to Gog Magog.
Hmm.
But anyhow, then there are other legends that Brutus then sailed off around looking for the place where he should found his capital city. And eventually he alighted on a spot on the north bank of the River Thames. And incidentally, Thames, the name Thames, is very ancient. It comes from Tammuz, which is the Syrian version of Osiris.
Yes.
Right? And as I said, we have this idea that there was a Syrian migration even before the Trojan one. And he founded a city they call Troia Newydd in Welsh, which in Latin becomes Trinovantum, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or New Troy, as we would say in English. So he founded the city of New Troy, and later the name was changed to London or Londinium. But you try getting academics to admit any of that, and yet they will admit, well, they have no choice. When you read Julius Caesar, he arrived in Kent, the county I live in, actually, and he arrived on the coast, and he marched up, and he crossed over the River Thames, had a battle there, and he fought against people called the Trinovantes.
Mm.
Well, they then say, well, this is just the tribe of the Trinovantes. Well, where does the name come from? It's the people of Trinovantum.
Ah.
It makes sense, doesn't it?
Yeah, of course.
The Trinovantes are the people of Trinovantum.
Mm.
And that's the tribe who occupied that area of London, that North Bank area, perhaps stretching into Essex and maybe a bit further north into Hertfordshire. They were the people who lived there.
Yeah.
So the king there, Cazivellaunus, or Caswallon, as we would call him in English, was the king of the Trinovantes who fought against Caesar. And he had an alliance, you know, with other peoples. We use this word tribe like these people are just savages from somewhere in Africa or Borneo or something, you know.
Right.
And that's kind of it's a totally false view. It's actually much more like the idea of the tribes of Israel. These are related people. They're not just a bunch of disparate groups, you know, living in huts and wearing skins and painting their bodies blue,
but
you know,
that we're
given in history books.
Well, exactly. And it's like we can't have that because we have the founders of civilizations. That's the ancient Grecian people, you know, so we can't have conflicting ideas here. So we got to eradicate something.
And yet, if you go into the Museum of London or the British Museum and you look at the Bronze Age relics and the Iron Age relics of the ancient Britons, you know, from before the time of the Romans, you discover these people were making wonderful jewelry. They had swords which are just as good as any Bronze Age swords you find anywhere else, you know.
Yeah.
And these people were using chariots, which is kind of, you read Homer and it's all about chariot warfare, isn't it?
Yeah.
And yet when Caesar arrived, chariots had disappeared on the continent by that time. And yet in Britain, they were still using chariots. And he was quite taken aback. And actually, they proved to be very effective against the Roman legions.
Hmm.
In fact, Caesar was driven out.
Yeah.
You know? And that doesn't happen very often, you know.
Hmm.
I mean, admittedly, he had things like the weather against him, and he lost half his fleet when he sailed over because it was one typical storm in the channel, you know.
Hmm.
But nevertheless, these ancient Britons were able to drive him out, and the Romans didn't come back here for 90 years. So, you know, you begin to understand that there's something a bit more to this history than we're told. And when you start seeing and interpreting things using the actual history, instead of trying to just work everything out from archaeology, see, this is the other problem we have, that people go and they dig up a mound or something, they find a few bones, and then they find maybe a small cup, and they say, well, these people are beaker folk, right?
Mm.
They give them a name, yeah, because they found a beaker buried with them, and they say they're beaker folk. This beaker looks a bit like one we've seen at a place called Lartain. Therefore, QED, they must be the same people
right.
who were living in Lartain, yeah? So we'll give them a name, and we'll call them Celts. Yeah, because that's the group name we'll give to all these kind of people. When you read Julius Caesar, you find out that the Celts were people who lived in central France, right? As we would call it, Gauls.
Mm.
Not all the Gauls were Celts. Yeah, some of the Gauls were called Belgae. Yeah, and there are other people down in the southwest of France, in a place called Guasguin, who are also Gascony, as we would say now. Who also were not Celts, and actually the Celts, so-called, are described in the ancient histories of the Romans and people as being quite tall people with either blonde hair and blue eyes or red hair,
mm-hmm.
right? Now, the ancient Britons were not like that. The ancient Britons, we have descriptions of the Cymry, the people from South Wales, for example, that tell us there are fairly short people, stocky, with dark hair, and a bit swarthy of appearance. A bit, they were Mediterranean people.
Hmm.
Yeah. So they're not the tall, beautiful blonde Celts that the scientists are telling us they were. They weren't like that at all. They were completely different people. And yet we have this name Celts, and they never ever call themselves Celts, and the Britons were never called Celts until about 1705. When
and doesn't that like mean like brutal or something like that? It's a kind of denotative term, I guess.
Well, I've nothing against the term. It's just it's not accurate.
Right, right.
It's like calling the French Italians or something. You know, it's not accurate. Mm. I mean, nothing against the Italians, but it's not true, is it?
Right.
So it'd be like calling you in Sweden saying, "Well, you're Germans." Yeah.
Right. Right.
Yeah. Your language is obviously a bit similar to German. You must be Germans. It's not true.
No.
You're separate peoples. So this is kind of what we're up against when we start delving a bit more deeply into areas that scientists and people like archaeologists don't want you to open this can of worms, you know.
Yeah.
They're quite happy with the kind of settled views. They're professors. They're teaching this stuff in their universities. They've got a job for life. They've come up through the ranks. They've climbed the greasy pole. They've got to where they are. They don't want you coming along showing everything that they're teaching is nonsense.
Yeah. I mean,
so we were up.
Go ahead.
Yep. So Robert Bovell was up against this. And I was along with him when we brought out this whole subject about the Orion mystery.
Yeah.
Showing the, I mean, we had a fascinating time. It really was fun. I can't begin to tell you what fun it was, because we got to know the guy Rudolf Gantenbrink, who sent the little robot up the shaft.
Uh-huh, you know, right.
You remember us reading about that.
Yeah.
And Rudolf was somewhat constrained about what he could say. I mean, he made this fantastic discovery of this little door with the hooks on it, and the Egyptians weren't saying anything. Yeah, nobody knew about this, right?
Hmm.
And he sent a video to Robert, and Robert said, "Well, why aren't you announcing this? This is fantastic."
Yeah.
So, well, I can't, you know, because of channels and blah blah blah.
Why? So, do you know why that was? Who was keeping it
partly? Partly, it's because it's all a matter of pride.
For the Egyptians.
For the Egyptians, mm-hmm. And here you have this German guy, Rudolf Gantenbrink, who. Almost as a, you know, by the way, said, "Can I look in this shaft? Nobody's been looked in this properly." And, you know, they at that time, they thought it was only about 8 meters long.
Yeah.
So he had to build this little robot to climb up this thing because it doesn't come out the other side. And he found this door. Well, he should have been given all the credit for that. I mean, he put his own money into this. He put his own time and effort into making this discovery. So these guys should have said, "Fantastic discovery, you know, Rudolf. You'll go down in the history books as being the guy who discovered that little door, mm. And we must see what we can do about probing it and looking further."
It. Yeah.
Yeah. But of course, it doesn't work like that. You know, all sorts of political considerations come in then. The German Archaeological Institute in Cairo become frightened that if they start rocking the boat saying too much, they'll lose their license. You know, the guy who's the head of the antiquities at the time, he would like to have some credit for this. Yeah. And then there's the whole question about who owns the pictures. Yeah. Because these pictures are worth a lot of money. Yeah. You can sell them to the networks, you know, in America and Europe and get them to pay money.
Mm.
And, you know, this money, who's it going to go to? Is it going to go to Mr. Gantenbrink, or is it going to go into the pocket of someone, or is it going to go to further archaeology? You know, there's all these kind of considerations, and they sort of forget about the fantastic excitement about this discovery.
Yeah, exactly.
So he sent this tape over, and Robert took it round and showed it to the people in the newspapers over here, and they went bananas.
Yeah, exactly. And do you think that is this the main reason why it's taking so incredibly long time? I mean, where is number two robot? They've been talking about this for years now, but nothing seems to be happening.
Yeah. Well, Rudolph, I mean, God bless Rudolph. I mean, Robert and I, we showed that film to the senior staff at the British Museum, right? There's the top guys there.
Mm.
And, you know, they had no more clue than anyone else about what they were looking at on that TV picture. And then we got Rudolph over, and he brought the robot with him, and he actually gave it to the British Museum in perpetuity.
Yeah.
With one proviso. It's actually there. You know, they haven't got it on display. I don't know if they'd let you see it. They might do if you went and asked, yeah, particularly, and said, I want to see Rudolph Gantermich's robot.
Yeah.
But he, with one proviso, that they would lend it back to him if needed it to do further research. Well, of course, by that time, the Egyptians were hopping mad, you know, and they weren't going to let him back in. They haven't let him back in to carry on his research. And he'd offered to do it for free,
mm-hmm,
to build a second robot if needed. Then when that wasn't good enough, I said, right, well, I will teach someone how to use this one, you know, how to do it. You know, doesn't have to be me, but let's get on and do it.
Yeah, exactly. No, he's excited. He wants to know what, you know, what actually is up there.
To make this work the next stage.
Right, right.
No, we must do this under the right protocol.
It's so weird. It's so strange.
So eventually they get someone else in to build a completely new robot.
Yeah.
And then they send that robot. And it's all Zaki Hawass. You know, Dr. Hawass has made this fantastic discovery. Dr. Hawass has drilled a hole, right? Well, this is what happens now in Egyptology. Unfortunately, nobody can do anything unless Dr. Hawass is standing next to them.
That's right.
Claiming the benefit of it.
Exactly.
So Egyptology, I'm afraid, probably for the next generation, has fallen into a deep hole. Nothing's going to get done. I mean, I can tell you, I've never actually met Dr. Hawass, and I have got nothing against him personally. But what I am annoyed about is that they have stopped progress when progress could have happened.
Yeah.
Now, back in the 1990s, I think it was 1998, 1999, I was in touch with an American group who were searching for the Hall of Records near the Sphinx. This is an ongoing thing. You probably heard of Edgar Cayce, haven't you?
Absolutely, yeah.
Sleeping Prophet, as they call him.
And the AAER, is that right?
ARE. Association for Research and Enlightenment.
Yes.
Well, he had made predictions that there is a chamber near the Sphinx where there is a Hall of Records. Now, if you're like me, you think, well, that's exciting. Let's go and look for it.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yep.
That's got to be your attitude, isn't it?
Yeah.
The attitude, and he claimed that these records would show a connection with Atlantis, right?
Mm-hmm.
That the pyramids and the Sphinx and so on have been built by people from Atlantis at the time of 10,000 BC or thereabouts. Long, long before dynastic Egypt, right?
Yeah.
Now, you know, I have an open mind on this. I mean, I'm quite happy to accept that the pyramids that we see today are built by the Fourth Dynasty. I don't have any problems with that.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm curious enough to want to know if there might be something earlier.
Of course.
Yes.
Of course.
This guy, this egg case, you could say the guy's a complete crackpot and a nutcase. But some of his, I think nearly all of his health readings that he gave people turned out to be remarkably accurate.
Yeah, yeah.
That he could say things, tell people what was wrong with them physically, and the medicine that they needed, he could, you know, tell them exactly what they needed. And sometimes things like he would prescribe a kind of medicine that was no longer available, and they'd say, well, you know, we can't get this. And he'd say, yes, if you go to such and such a chemist shop, you know, in this town here, and it's on the second shelf up at the back, yeah,
right.
Find a bottle there.
Right. Incredible, yeah.
And sure enough, they go there and, you know, they have a look. Oh, yes, there's this old bottle here with a curling label or whatever. so, you know, this guy, he's certainly got something and enough to make you want to investigate what he's saying a bit further.
Yeah.
At least in my opinion. And it may not be totally accurate. I don't know. I've had some dealings with clairvoyants and I tend to find they're a bit of a mixed bag, you know, that some of what they say seems to be good. Others seems to be kind of mishmash of fantasy or a misunderstanding symbols or,
well, it's like what you're getting in any field of work, isn't it? I mean, there is good, you know, craftsmanship and those are not, and, you know, that happens. Yeah. course.
So I would never take something someone says just because they said it, you know?
Mm, yeah.
You then say, well, that's interesting. That's a hypothesis. Let's have a look and see what we can do with that. And if we can prove this to be correct.
Yeah.
Or not, you know? And if it's not, fair enough. I'll tell you another little story when I finish this. Anyway, so I was actually in Cairo at the hotel, and I was waiting for the party of Dr. Shaw, Dr. Joseph Shaw, who was funding an investigation. He had been doing this for years. And in fact, he was one of the backers of the ARE, and he had actually paid for the education of Dr. Zaki Hawass. So, you know, this guy is not an idiot, and he's not a nut. He's actually had been a very high up member of the board of a large drug company in America, and he had used his money to set up a foundation to investigate what Edgar Cayce had said. And they'd been doing surveys around Giza looking for this secret chamber, using ground-penetrating radar and so forth. And they got some interesting anomalies. And they found the spots that they wanted to look, right?
Yeah.
And they got permission from the Egyptians to carry out a dig, right, to have a look in this particular place. So you can't just sort of go along with a spade and say, can I dig here? You know, my clairvoyance told me that if I dig right here, I'm going to find the tomb of Imhotep or something. You can't do that. It doesn't work. You've got to have an academic university behind you.
Mm-hmm.
And so he was working with a Florida State University, had been for years, and was funding them to send over a team of archaeologists and booked all their flights, booked their hotels. Everything was set up. I was going to be there to act perhaps as the documentarist of this, write it all up. So I was there as well, and I was waiting because I was already in Egypt for another reason. And then they didn't show, and I got a message saying that they weren't coming after all, and it turned out that at the last minute, the Egyptians had turned around and said, no, I'm sorry, you can't come here. It's not politically advisable.
Really?
So, you know, this is kind of what you're up against. I mean, you and I, we want to know the answers now. We don't want to wait sort of 30 years.
Of course not.
and then, you know, 30 years' time, oh, yes, we'll send another robot up. We'll probe that door and...
Well, I got to be honest with you, Adrian. I think something else is going on, and I think that the seeming troubles, so to speak, on the surface are there to kind of, dull all of our interest in this in a little bit. I think that they've already actually been behind there themselves, without the cameras, without all of that, and try to figure it out. Either there's something, you know, incredibly shocking behind there that they cannot, yes, you know, reveal or something like that. I don't know what's going on. It's a guess. I cannot prove that, but it's just a feeling that I have when I'm watching this circus here.
Well, I'll give you another, little clue on this. When that door was first found, shortly afterwards, I was put in touch with a clairvoyant lady over here by her publishers. Now, don't get me wrong, you know, I'm not someone that goes running around to clairvoyance all the time. I'm not like that, but I do have an open enough mind,
sure,
to be interested in these people, and sometimes they say interesting things. And I went to see the publishers, and I met the lady, and she had received a number of drawings. Now, this lady was, I won't say illiterate, but she certainly was not a good writer, right?
Mm.
She hadn't done more than the basic minimum schooling and then gone to work in a factory. So she wasn't someone who was highly educated. But she claimed that she was in touch with aliens, right?
Mm-hmm.
And there's another subject to flag. Again, you know, I'm not someone that goes around saying, oh, I see aliens, or, you know, wonderful flying saucers, they're going to come down here and rescue us. I have an open mind on the subject. I mean, I'm quite convinced that there are other places which are inhabited in the universe, because it would be very strange and odd if this one insignificant planet going around a star on the edge of the Milky Way was the only place that's inhabited.
Yeah.
When you've got more stars in the sky than there are grains of sand on the Earth.
Hmm.
You know,
yeah.
To put it in context. Hmm. If you went to all the beaches on the Earth and you took all the grains of sand, there's still not enough there to match the number of stars that there are in the universe.
Yep.
So it'd be kind of stupid to think that this is the only place where there's any kind of life.
Yep.
Whether they're able to communicate with us and come here, that's another subject.
That's right. I'm much the same way, Adrian. Just about we can't know either way, so why dismiss it? Or even, you know, if we don't know, why prop it up? You know, we need to have balance about these things, you know.
Yeah, and our science, you know, we vaunt ourselves about it, but it's only about 400 years old.
That's right, yeah.
But you could say, roughly speaking, the time of Galileo marks the beginning of modern science. Yeah, okay, we've got stuff which came from a bit earlier, but people weren't making any progress, really, and this will tie in with what I'm going to be talking about with the Invisible College. But people weren't making any progress. The idea of progress didn't really occur until around about 1600, a little bit before that maybe. But basically, the ideas before that was that you preserve the knowledge of the past and you discuss it. Yeah.
Mm.
So you study Aristotle because Aristotle is a genius, yeah, and you interpret what he's written. You maybe look a bit at Plato and you study Plato because he's also a genius, but you don't question what these great masters have discovered or said. Yeah, their words are set in stone. You know.
Yeah. Right.
So you can interpret, but only within that field. It was only around about 1600. That people began to throw off those shackles and say, look, we must find new knowledge. We must break out of this egg. You know, we've got to go on and there is more knowledge to be discovered. And it's not a bad thing.
Yeah.
But anyway, I'll talk about that a bit later.
Adrian, I'm sorry to cut you off here, but I think we also need to begin to round things up here for the first hour. And what I want to do is I want to spend just a little bit of time about 8 minutes to 10 minutes on talking about two different things. First of all, in this first hour, I want you to mention the Invisible College as a briefly what it is for people who want to check it out, where they are going to go and so forth. And then in the last 5 or 4 minutes, we can also talk a little bit about your upcoming appearance at the AV2 conference. Then we can round things up and continue talking more about this fascinating area. But so tell us a little bit about the Invisible College and then a little bit about the conference, okay?
Right, okay.
Yes.
Now, around about 1610, or 1614, a bunch of pamphlets started appearing in Europe, supposedly written by followers of someone called Christian Rosenkreuz.
Yep.
As we would say, Christian Red Cross.
Rosicrucians.
The Rosicrucians, yeah. And that's nothing to do with these people you see advertising in magazines today, you know, saying, you know, write in and you can have a correspondence course, make you illuminated. Nothing to do with that. This was actually around 1614. These pamphlets started appearing in Europe, but they were actually written a little bit earlier than that. And the Rosicrucians claimed that their leader, Christian Rosenkreuz, was a real man who had lived about 150 years earlier and had journeyed to the East and had originally been going to Jerusalem, but he ended up in Damascus, and he was initiated by the local Arabs there into their knowledge, particularly about healing and use of herbs and so forth. And then he traveled elsewhere in the Islamic world, and then he came back to Europe thinking that he was, you know, they'd be delighted to have this new knowledge, that he would go to the universities and tell the professors about this new knowledge. Or I suppose it was old knowledge that he was bringing back. And they'd all want to learn and know about this. And of course, it's not like that at all. They didn't want to hear about it. As we were discussing earlier, they were quite happy with the situation where they're discussing Aristotle. They didn't want to hear anything else.
Right.
So then he went off and he founded a little group of his own with 8 followers, and he would teach them. And then each time one of them would die, someone else would take his place. So there's kind of a small group. And their idea was they were going to discover new knowledge. And basically they were following what was then called natural philosophy, we would now call science.
Yeah.
that this would be the way forwards, and it would heal the great rift of the religious rifts that were appearing, you know, in the 16th and 17th century, the tremendous problems about religion in Europe, which led to the 30 Years' War a bit later.
Right.
Anyway, so these pamphlets were published, and they announced that people could come and join this group, and they would be taught the way. And that produced two responses. The first response was people said, where can I join? I want to be part of this. Yeah, I've been waiting for this all my life. I really, really want to join.
Mm.
And the other response is, where are these people so we can chop their heads off?
Right, right.
Yeah. Yes. So they were very wisely kept their heads down. And then the idea went around that this was really all just a hoax. It was just a joke. There's nothing really behind this. It's all nonsense.
You're saying that they had to be secret in order to even be able to exist at all, right?
Yeah.
Mm.
And if anyone did join, they did so secretly. Well, we haven't got time to go into the whole business of the Rosicrucian furore. I have written a bit about this in one of my books called The New Jerusalem.
Okay.
Mm. Anyway, in 1642 in London, a group of eminent gentlemen, people like Sir Christopher Wren, Reverend Wilkins, Robert Boyle, various other people that were scientists, as we would now call them, got together and started meeting privately in Gresham College, which was a special institution in London where it was set up as a benefactory towards the people of London, where it's kind of a free school. They would give people lectures, you know, the ordinary people, teach them mathematics and music and things like this. They started meeting together there, and then later they moved to Oxford. And you've got to understand, this is the time of the English Civil War, when the Roundheads and the Cavaliers are fighting.
Mm.
In Europe, you've still got the 30 Years' War going on. And it's a very tense time between Protestants and Catholics and Royalists and Roundheads. And they made a pact, and they said, oh, we won't discuss any of that. We'll leave politics outside the door. We'll leave religion outside the door. We're going to focus on making finding new knowledge, new science. Now, that group were called the Invisible College. And that later, after the restoration of King Charles II, they became the Royal Society of London, which is still the most eminent scientific body in the world. Had a royal charter, and Charles II himself was its patron. But something was lost in the translation, because the Invisible College, they weren't only following science, they were also investigating the Bible, they were investigating religion.
Mm-hmm.
They believed that there were two books of God. There's the written text, the scriptures, you know, handed down, divinely revealed, however you want to call it. And then there was the book of nature. So you had to read the two books together. Science studies the book of nature, but you also study the book of knowledge, the Bible.
Right.
So that's why people like Isaac Newton were doing the two things.
Yeah.
So they were investigating nature, but they were also very religious, investigating the Bible, trying to understand about prophecy and so forth. And very much what they were doing was they were rebalancing the situation away from religion towards practicality and knowledge, and extending knowledge and science and logic. But unfortunately, that pendulum has swung now too far the other way. Yeah?
Yes.
We're now in a situation where people deny the world of spirit. They deny that there's anything worth looking at in the Bible, for instance, or in religion. Certainly, the Orthodoxy do. Religion has become kind of a peripheral thing where just a few old people go along to church and, you know, pray to some invisible God who probably doesn't exist. That's the attitude, right? Well, my feeling is that we need another reformation of this. We need to rebalance again, but this time we need to bring back that spiritual element into what we're investigating.
Into the scientific field.
Into the scientific field. So that's why I've started the Invisible College. But this time, you see, they called it Invisible because a lot of their stuff was done by letter. They would, you know, they didn't always meet up together, but they would write to each other.
It's not a physical place where people went to attend and so forth.
They did attend, yeah, in London and in Oxford.
Right.
I think mostly in Oxford, actually. But there were European members and people, you know, who couldn't easily get to see what the latest experiments were or whatever. Mm. So they wrote papers and they circulated these papers and letters between themselves. Kind of snail mail version of the internet.
Right, there you go. Exactly.
So I sort of felt that it's time that we did something similar and try and draw together people that share a common interest in this rebalancing in preparation for what I believe is major changes that are coming in our time.
Mm.
Yeah. And their work gave birth to what we call the Enlightenment. Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's no longer very enlightened.
Exactly.
It's become very dark.
Yeah.
So we need kind of a new instauration, as a word that Sir Francis Bacon used a lot, this kind of idea of renovation, taking something and making it new again. We need to do that again in our time, and we need to question everything. We can't just sit back and say, well, we've sorted out the problems. We know, you know, now we know how the sun works, we know how the planets work, we know everything. Yeah? That, to me, is a very arrogant, stupid attitude to
Absolutely.
Take.
Absolutely.
Because if I don't know how much science you've done, but when I went to school, we did science. We were taught about atoms and molecules and electrons going around in orbits. And as soon as I went to university, I discovered actually that model is not right.
Hmm.
Everything was then wave theory and the shapes of orbitals and completely different. You had to unlearn everything you had learned before.
Exactly.
And start again.
Yeah.
So why do we think the models that we have now are fixed? They're not. They're going to change, and we're going to discover that we're as ignorant as people were in the Middle Ages.
Right.
So it's not quite, you know.
So it's about not about also, you know, shattering all the old, but taking from that what is good and utilizing that knowledge, but then continuing to build and evolve. Because again, the scientific field is making a lot of, you know, progress in that sense. A lot of things are being drawn to the table, you know, that people can look at, and especially over the web now, one person can read a report about a scientific discovery and have a totally different other interpretation of what they've found than another guy. And that is what's so interesting here.
Yes, that's right. But the problem that we have is everything's becoming so lost in the detail.
That's right.
Scientists become specialists in very, very narrow fields. And so they assume everybody else understands their field, other fields, that is. So they concentrate on their own. Mm-hmm. And they assume that what they read in books that other people have written at a general level must be right.
Yeah, there you go.
But nobody's taking the broad view and seeing the whole picture, because that's not what they're taught. And that's not where you're going to get funding for research.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you're not funded to be a Renaissance man.
Exactly, yeah.
No one will pay your bills for that. You know, if you're rich enough, you can be a Renaissance man if you like.
Well, I think it has to also come from a passion in a sense as well. I mean, this isn't people who are going to live off of, you know, tenure, if you will. This has to be a driving force from within the person who is engaged in this type of work as well. Obviously, economics and economic help is always needed and must be there in order to survive, obviously. But I think it's good that it's done from the outside, if you know what I mean, because again, there is where the new discovery actually lies, and there is where people are bold enough to go into areas that the mainstream won't dare to go into, you know?
You're exactly right, and you've put your finger on it, that it needs people who are on the edge, right?
Yeah.
To actually move forwards with these things. And in the 17th century, people like Isaac Newton were on the edge. People like myself are on the edge now. People like Robert Bovell are on the edge.
That's right.
You know? Yeah. And we're sort of moving into areas where sort of angels fear to tread sometimes. but it has to be done, because if nobody does that, everything becomes stagnant. So I've set up this Invisible College, and partly it's I'm going to share my discoveries with the world. Right? That sounds a bit boastful, but I've been at this for about 40 years. Investigating this and that and the other, and I've had some extraordinary experiences myself. But also I want other people to share their experiences and discoveries and to write papers and to present things. And hopefully together we're going to sort of move on to building a new paradigm. I don't think necessarily that it's going to do it, you know, I'm not stupid enough to think we can do it on our own.
Right.
But it's all part of what's happening in the world today, is we're building a new paradigm that will allow fresh views and vision, which is going to be really important for this coming new age that we're moving into. So that's kind of what I'm going to be talking a bit about at the AV2 conference. The AV2 conference, I'm quite excited to be invited along to that. I mean, I'm not involved in the kind of conspiracy areas that some of the guest speakers are going to be talking about. But I'm interested to hear that people like David Bellamy are going to be there. You know, he's a very eminent botanist, well known as a TV personality over here. And yet he dares to question this anthropogenic global warming. You know, he doesn't. I don't buy the CO2 business.
Me you know, neither.
But
no.
It's a convenient method of people. As someone put it to me, if you said that you want to study the life of squirrels in the Ashdown Forest in Sussex, you won't get a grant. But if you say you want to examine the impact of global warming on the life of squirrels in Ashdown Forest,
Oh my God, the grants keep on coming in, don't they? Well, that's because it supports the current agenda. And there is also where I actually see the conspiracy, the hand that is controlling things, that we want to have this put forward now for whatever reason that might be, of course. But you have to follow the money, as they say, as well, in order to understand this.
Well, you have to follow the money, and you also have to follow the wish to limit people's freedoms.
Exactly. There you go.
If said to you, I'm sorry, you're not allowed to have a car, you'll say, you know, how dare you? You know, I want a car. You know, I have a right to a car. I have a human right to have a car. But if you say, no, you mustn't have a car because that car is polluting the atmosphere. It's causing global warming.
Yeah.
And it's going to make polar bears extinct in 30 years' time. Yeah.
Mm.
How can you answer that? You then say, well, I better get on my bicycle. It becomes an unanswerable ethical dilemma. So you're kind of moving politics.
Well, exactly. And they're putting it, sorry to cut you off, Adrian, but I think that they're putting it consciously on that particular point as well, because they're making it into an emotional question instead of a scientific question, that where you can kind of debate about this stuff, you know.
Yeah, you're destroying the world for my children and my grandchildren. How dare you?
Exactly.
Yeah. So we must pass a law to stop you doing this. We must make a law that you are not allowed to have a car. And this is what's happening. As I say, I'm not into the political sphere, only peripherally where it impacts on me personally, but you know, I've kind of kept out of that because I feel I need to keep my powder dry for other things. But, you know, I do think that what's happening in the AV2 conference is very relevant, and it's worth hearing what people have to say about these matters.
Absolutely.
People like Ian Crane, I've been to one of his lectures before, and it was actually quite illuminating. He actually predicted, I was there last year in Glastonbury, he gave a lecture, and he actually predicted this financial banking collapse before it happened.
Yeah.
He said, this is what they're going to do. And they're going to make you all poor, so you'll all be slaves.
And here we are, in a way.
And here we are.
Really interesting.
Isn't it just,
So, I mean, it's. I think overall, then, it's going to be great, first of all, definitely, to see you speak at the AV2 conference. And I can give out the website for that again for people who want to head over there and check out some of the other speakers as well, and tickets and so forth. AVII.co.uk or thealternativeview.co.uk. But then again, I want you also to mention your Invisible College, how people will be able to go to the website, what they can do there a little bit briefly before we round things off here for the first hour.
Well, the website, I launched it last week. We've already got some members have joined. I think we've got about 14 have signed up without knowing any more about it than just what I've said.
Right.
Basically, you can come along, you can join. It only costs £10 a year, which is nothing. But we need to charge something, otherwise we can't keep the thing going. And then when they get in, there's various faculties which I'm building. I'm going to be adding material to them gradually in different fields like ancient history and self-development and prophecy and, you know, different areas that people could investigate and contribute to, because this isn't a one-way street, as I said before. And then we have a forum where people can come along and they can discuss ideas with each other in the forum. And gradually, you know, there's going to be videos. There are a couple of videos on there already. There's one that I did an interview with J.J. Hertak. Have you heard of him?
Yeah, definitely. A very interesting
He's
guy.
He's a Enoch. Well, he actually visited my house, and I sat him down, and I did an interview with him. So I've put that up there, discussing the Keys of Enoch and how he came to write it.
Wonderful.
Now, I've actually read that book. So I think it's the first time he's been interviewed by someone who's actually read the book.
That's a good idea,
helped,
yeah.
You know,
yeah,
because it's a difficult book to read. And I've got another video there of a fire ceremony that was I attended in Belize. A Mayan elder, Carlos Barrios, did a fire ceremony in an ancient Mayan temple.
Yeah.
And a group of us were standing around, and that was fascinating. So I filmed it, and I've put the film up there with a commentary. So that's there. You know, people can watch that. And there will be other things added gradually over time. But this is very much a work in progress. It's quite embryonic at present. But I want people to come along and join and help us do it, you know, because I can't do it all myself.
Exactly. And the idea here then, I guess, is to that people should also then contribute material. Is that correct?
Yes.
And the exchange of ideas, as it were.
Yes. And the material, I'm not going to just put up any old rubbish and nonsense. Everything will be peer-reviewed. So there should be quality material that's coming through. Because I don't know, I mean, you've probably had quite a few dealings, but there's plenty of people with some crazy, crazy ideas. And there's a difference between crazy, crazy and being on the edge.
Well, there is, so, absolutely.
Yeah. So I try to filter things a bit, but not too much.
Well, exactly. It needs to have a certain set of filters in some cases, especially if you have an idea about what it is that you want to try to achieve. You know, you can't just let anything in there, and you know, you have to have a certain set of rules, as it were. Tell us the website then, where people can go to check it out.
Right, it's www.theinvisiblecollege.net. So the Invisible College is all one word. So www.theinvisiblecollege.net. Now, if you go on the internet, you'll find there are a few invisible college websites around. I'm not the only person to realize that's a great name. But it's the .net is what you want. Theinvisiblecollege.net.
Very good. And we will have these and other links up on redascreations.com as well, so you can find them easily. And again, the main website, Adrian, I can mention, adriangilbert.co.uk. And from there, you can find the other links as well, of course. So, Adrian, let's take a little break here. We're going to listen to some music, and then we'll be back and talk more in our member section. I'm definitely looking forward to continuing on the thread where we left off here. So thank you very much for this segment, Adrian. Stay with us, and we'll be right back. Go to adriangilbert.co.uk for more information, articles, research, and do take a look at some of the book titles. We are going to continue talking about the opening of the Stargate in our members section with Adrian Gilbert. This is about the connection between the star constellation of Orion, the Mount of Olives, and the Great Pyramid, and the opening of the South and North Gates, and how we are in a time period right now in terms of precession and prophecy, where potential new possibilities related to the consciousness and awareness of people is opening up. We'll also discuss the documentary film Signs in the Sky and much more, but we'll begin to talk about the account of the clairvoyant that was sharing information with Adrian about what could possibly be behind Gantenbrink's door, the door at the end of the shaft inside the Great Pyramid. So don't miss this fascinating part two. Our website is redeyescreations.com. Head on over there to find out how to access our members area and tune in. We'll talk more after this break.
Don't you know that I'll be around to guide you through your weakest moments, to leave them behind you, turning nightmares only shadows. Cast some light, it'll be all right. sunlight and you'll be all right. Catch some light and you'll be all right for now. Cross it so long. Crosses along the boulevard. Crosses along the boulevard. Crosses along the boulevard. Streets outside your window overflow. People reminded by the looks on their faces. No, that's it.